Security is the foundation for development. Stability is the prerequisite for prosperity. We should implement a holistic approach to national security and improve our national security system, strengthen our capacity for safeguarding national security, and enhance public safety governance, as well as to improve the social governance system.
He also reiterated Beijing's opposition to secessionist activities and external interference in Taiwan. Xi's remarks came in his closing speech to China's parliament, the National People's Congress, where last week he secured unanimous support for an unprecedented third term in office. During his speech, Xi also said China must achieve greater self-resilience and strength in science and technology, a call that comes as the United States blocks China's access to chip-making equipment and other cutting-edge technologies. Meanwhile, China's premier has said some people in the U.S. have been trumpeting decoupling from China in recent years.
I know that in recent years, some in the United States have been trumpeting the idea of decoupling from China, and sometimes it could become quite a hot topic on the media. But I wonder how many people can truly benefit from this kind of hype. According to Chinese statistics, two-way trade between China and the United States last year totaled $760 billion, which again set a new record in history.
Qiang said China and the United States can't and must cooperate, and there are a lot that the two countries can achieve by working together. He stressed that encirclement and suppression are in no one's interests. The latest remarks by Xi Jinping regarding China's focus on security comes as relations with the U.S. have hit their lowest point in decades. Chinese officials had previously warned that Washington's efforts to contain Beijing's interests could lead to conflict and confrontation between the two superpowers. America's increasingly confrontational posture toward China is a significant shift in the U.S. foreign policy that needs greater scrutiny and debate. For most of the past half century, the United States sought to reshape China through economic and diplomatic engagement. In the case of the Trump administration, through economic and diplomatic disengagement. The Biden administration, by contrast, has shelved the idea that China can be changed in favor of the hope that it can be checked. The White House has moved to limit economic ties with China, to limit China's access to technology with military applications, to pull back from international institutions where the United States has long sought to engage China, and to strengthen ties with China's neighbors. In recent months, the United States has restricted semiconductor exports to China, and this week it moved ahead with plans to help Australia obtain nuclear submarines. The administration also is seeking to impose new restrictions on American investments in certain Chinese companies. In treating China as a growing threat to American interests, it is acting with broad support, including from leading Republicans, much of the military and foreign policy establishments, and a growing portion of the business community. China also is demonstrating a greater willingness to engage in worrying provocations, mounting military displays in the South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. China and the U.S. have locked themselves into a new cycle of recriminations, provoking fresh worries that the world's two biggest economies are heading down a path that could one day lead to the once unthinkable, the possibility of open conflict. The dueling narratives brought into focus how the U.S. and China increasingly have one thing in common, a growing distrust of the other side. Even worse, the escalating rhetoric is entrenching divisions that could make it harder for both sides to find a way to coexist peacefully over the long term.
In an utter disregard for the public, the French Senate has voted in favor of President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms plan, bringing the package one more step toward becoming a law. 195 members of the upper house of the French parliament voted for the legislation, with 112 against. That amid days-long nationwide protests against the move. The plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, has drawn hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions, out to the streets or walk out from their jobs across France. The protests and rolling strikes have affected refineries, public transport and garbage collections, with the aim to pressure the government to withdraw the plan. Macron has argued that the procedure is essential to ensure the pension system does not run out of money. His cabinet members have praised the reforms. In a tweet, Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren wrote, "It is a key step to make a reform happen that will guarantee the future of our pension system." Now that the Senate has adopted the bill, it will be reviewed by a joint committee of lower and upper house lawmakers. If approved, the plan will be put to vote in the country's National Assembly later this week. That's where the government needs a majority to sign the bill into law. If the government fails to assemble a majority, Prime Minister Warren could deploy a highly controversial constitutional tool known as Article 49(3) to push the legislation through without a vote. Elizabeth Warren has repeatedly said she wants to avoid resorting to the 49(3) procedure, but she might have no other option if there is a real risk of not having enough votes. The possibility of using Article 49(3) comes as many unionists have already warned President Macron against forcing the parliament by pushing the text through without a vote from MPs of the National Assembly. Secretary General of the French CFDT Union Laurent Berger says using 49(3) would be very dangerous, as it risks creating a great degree of bitterness. French unions have called for an 8th round of nationwide demonstrations on the day of voting to keep up the pressure on the government and the parliament. The opponents of the plan argue that it would penalize low-skilled workers who start their careers early while reducing their right to leisure and a long retirement at the end. Many appear ready to fight for a better work-life balance after years of being pushed to work harder. But for many others, raising the retirement age feels like the last straw. For some others, it is a red line. According to government figures, nearly 1.3 million people took to the streets Tuesday last week to vent their anger, making it the highest turnout since the start of the protest movement. The figure is indicative of the fact that the French are showing signs of burnout and a change in attitude towards the workplace. Jean Jaurès Foundation researchers found that although 60% of the French rated their job as really important in their lives in 1990, only 21% did so in October 2022. Moreover, 60% of the French say they would rather earn less and have more free time, which is itself a sign of frustration among the French public about the jobs they're working. If this trend continues to persist, no one would guess what economic repercussions will be waiting for the French society soon. From a different perspective, this frustration with the workplace clashes with the president, who pitched himself as a candidate of work. For Macron, however, there is a lot at stake. Failure to reform pensions would tarnish the rest of his second and final term and stop his reformist passion dead in his tracks. On the other hand, the growing discontent with the establishment would be something the government would not want to deal with ever.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
History of Knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with the fourth episode of the series in which we make you familiar with a few Iranian scientists to whom mankind is indebted in various fields of sciences. If you remember, we talked briefly on Abu Musa Khwarazmi, the great mathematician who was also outstanding in astronomy and has rendered great services to both fields. Today, we will continue discussing math and getting familiar with another Iranian genius in the field, namely Abu Reyhan Biruni. Stay tuned, please. Math is considered an applicable science in the broad region of the Islamic Iranian civilization. In view of this, many discoveries have taken place in this land in various branches of math. All these occurred while a dark era of ignorance and enmity with knowledge was dominant in most parts of the world. Turkish historian and author Halil İnalcık explains the conditions in those days. What shaped the Islamic civilization was production of knowledge based on Islamic thought, theosophy and philosophy, which took place through the Islamic Iranian culture in the 4th century AH. In that era, Europe was in ignorance. A synthesis of the Iranian and Islamic cultures was formed during the first era of the Islamic civilization. Iranian researcher Dr. Musa Najafi also says, the 4th and 5th centuries were the era of climax of the Islamic civilization. In the next eras too, the Islamic civilization was in its zenith. For example, the 9th century AH was the period of the rule of Safavids in Iran. But the Islamic civilization, in its climax, delivered great figures to the human civilization such as Ibn Sina, Abu Reyhan Biruni, Farabi, Khaja Nizam al-Mulk Tusi, and many other thinkers. In the first period of thriving the Islamic civilization, there were many narrators and scholars of hadith and thinkers, mainly helped this civilization flourish in philosophy and the common sciences of their age. Yet, in the next periods, indexes changed and most of them tilted towards mystics, art, and architecture. Turkish researcher of Islamic sciences, Dr. Fuat Sezgin, says, I'd like to show you a device whose name has not been registered in the history of math. It is Abu Reyhan Biruni, who introduces this device to us. This device is used for drawing circle on the pattern of planet Earth. If you don't have such a device, you won't be able to draw an accurate circle on planet Earth. This is among the devices which were mentioned in Abu Reyhan Biruni's book. The name of the device can be translated as interconnected two-sided ruler. You put the circle or page between the two rulers and draw your desired line or shape on both sides. This device had remained unknown in the history of math till 19th century. Who is Abu Reyhan Biruni? Abu Reyhan Mohammad ibn Ahmad Biruni was the prominent Iranian scientist of the second half of the 4th century and early 5th century AH. He has elaborately written innumerable books in math, astronomy, pharmaceuticals, and geography. Biruni is among the geniuses whose scientific figure was revealed to the world through the progress of sciences. He was a master of most natural sciences of his time and was among the first persons who embarked on finding a special weight of many objects. His findings were so precise that his calculations have very little difference with what recent scholars have found with modern equipment. Abu Reyhan would travel to different regions and measure the longitude and latitude of those regions and would determine the location of every city on a globe. Years later, he successfully drew those regions on a flat map. This was, in fact, the prelude to cartography as a subcategory of geography. Biruni managed to calculate the most accurate length of the Earth in his time and raised the likelihood of the Earth's rotation around itself. This Iranian genius spent long periods of his life in India. He studied the history, beliefs, customs, and philosophy of Indians. The Indian scholars would not welcome him at first, but very soon he drew their trust and was invited to various circles and gatherings to show a part of the Iranian culture and civilization on one hand, and study their customs and past record more deeply. These studies resulted in writing the book Tahqiq Mal al-Hind, or Research on India. After over 1,000 years, this book has been the best reference for research on India. Abu Reyhan Biruni, in an essay, studies the precedence of finding the important theorem of sines and tangents by Iranian scientists and examines the share of each of them. Biruni's studies are very useful for the students who want to be top scholars in geometry. His explanations on various geometrical and mathematical concepts are different from those of Euclid. He tries to give more tangible definitions of concepts. Biruni has explained the rule for ascending of foundations and springs in a scientific language. Then he speaks about the running of water from the depth of wells and springs. A brief look at Biruni's works indicates that he was one of the most prolific writers of the Islamic era. If we judge him according to his works, we should say that he has spent a lot of time on each of these works and written them with profound research. That's why he describes his love of his works to the love of people toward their children. Abu Reyhan Biruni has presented a list of his works, according to which he has completed 103 works, left 10 works unfinished, and authored 25 works in collaboration with other writers. The Iranian genius used to call himself as a servant of knowledge. He would say, "I thank God for being able to be at the service of knowledge since childhood." A scholar by the name of Abu al-Hasan Ali ibn Isa writes, "When Abu Reyhan was at his deathbed, I went to visit him. He asked me a jurisprudential issue. I told him that it was not a proper time to ask such a question. He said, 'Which one is better, to know this and die or die without knowing it?' I told him the answer and left him. A few steps away, I heard the sound of mourning and crying from Abu Reyhan's house." This event has been narrated in historical books on the last moments of Biruni's life. He passed away in 440 AH, 1049 AD, in the city of Ghaznain.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three-quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called Track Trace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sin, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one customs administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guayu.
When we went to the Guayu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guayu, but we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guayu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guayu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year. But it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guayu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. It will take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbour, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they would look at it as condemned goods, so you're not going to pay the value that you would pay it ordinarily.
At Tema Harbour, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPs officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbour controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers. We need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In the first direct confrontation between Russia and the United States since the start of the Ukraine war, an American drone was shot down, raising tensions between senior Kremlin and White House officials. Washington claims that the actions of the Russians caused the downing of the drone, but Moscow has a different story. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Moscow says the diplomatic relations between Russia and the United States have plunged into a lamentable state amid a row between the two countries over a drone incident. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters on Wednesday, 15th of March, the bilateral relations were in dire straits after the US accused Russia of downing one of its reconnaissance drones over the Black Sea. The US military on Tuesday, 14th of March, claimed a Russian fighter plane had clipped the propeller of one of its spying drones flying over the Black Sea in international airspace, causing the aircraft to crash into the water. Russia rejected that its forces had made any effort to down the drone and instead suggested that the US aircraft had possibly crashed due to sharp maneuvering. Meanwhile, hot on the heels of the crashing of the US spy drone, Russia warns the United States that it will retaliate proportionately to all future American provocations. The Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement on Wednesday, 15th of March, flights of American strategic unmanned aerial vehicles off the coast of Crimea are provocative in nature, which creates preconditions for an escalation of the situation in the Black Sea zone. The statement added, Russia is not interested in such a development of events, but it will continue to respond proportionately to all provocations. According to Moscow, the incident happened as the unmanned aerial vehicle was flying over the waters of the Black Sea in the area of the Crimean Peninsula towards the Russian state border. Crimea declared independence from Ukraine on 17th of March 2014 and formally applied to fall under Russian sovereignty following a referendum. Kiev and Washington have refused to recognize Moscow's sovereignty over Crimea. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu also told the Pentagon chief that Washington's increased intelligence gathering against Russia had led to a drone incident. The Defense Ministry said in a statement, Sergei Shoigu told his American counterpart Lloyd Austin that increased intelligence activities against the interests of the Russian Federation, as well as the non-compliance with the restricted flight zone declared by Moscow, had led to the drone incident. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has warned Moscow to operate its military aircraft with caution after Washington accused one of Russia's jets of allegedly downing an American military drone in international airspace. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin vowed on Wednesday, 15th of March, that U.S. aircraft will fly wherever international law allows, after Russia's ambassador to the United States said the U.S. military's actions close to the Russian territory are unacceptable. Anatoly Antonov called on Washington to stop hostile flights near Russia's borders. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke by phone with his Russian counterpart Sergei Shoigu about Tuesday's incident over the Black Sea, where the Pentagon claimed a Russian Su-27 fighter jet collided with a U.S. military drone, causing it to crash. Washington called the incident reckless and unprofessional, while Moscow denounced U.S. accusations and instead blamed the United States for conducting hostile flights near Russia's borders. Lloyd Austin told reporters just following the call with Sergei Shoigu, he said the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows, and it is incumbent upon Russia to operate its military aircraft in a safe and professional manner. Meanwhile, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, said the Pentagon is still analyzing video and data from the drone to see exactly what happened. He told reporters, "Was it intentional or not? We don't yet know." The Russian Defense Ministry in Moscow said on Tuesday, 14th of March, it detected an American MQ-9 drone over the waters of the Black Sea in the area of the Crimean Peninsula, flying towards the Russian state border. It added the drone was flying with its transponders turned off and flight jets were scrambled to identify it. The Russian Defense Ministry said as a result of sharp maneuvering at around 9:30 hours, Moscow time, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle entered an uncontrolled flight with a loss of altitude and collided with the surface of the water. The Russian Defense Ministry stressed that the Russian fighters did not use their onboard weapons, made no contact with the unmanned aerial vehicle, and safely returned to their home airfield. The U.S. newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. Hawkish Republican Senator Marco Rubio says the United States should begin flying more military drones with fighter jet escorts over the Black Sea region following the crash of an American drone there. Republican Senator Marco Rubio, the vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, claim Russia downed a U.S. Reaper drone over the Black Sea on Tuesday, 14th of March, which is a test for the Biden administration. Rubio added, "It's a test to see if we'll respond to it." Washington called the incident reckless and unprofessional, while Moscow rejected U.S. accusations and instead blamed the United States for conducting hostile flights near Russia's borders. The U.S. military released footage of what it described as an unsafe and unprofessional intercept by the Russian warplane. The short video footage purportedly shows a Russian Su-27 fighter jet approaching the back of the U.S. MQ-9 drone on Tuesday, 14th of March, and dumping fuel as it passes. The European command said the warplane made a second pass at the unpiloted drone, again dumping fuel before colliding with the drone. Senator Marco Rubio said, "I think our response should be to fly more of these in that area and to potentially have them escorted by U.S. fighter jets, which are manned and have the capability to respond." Senator Rubio said members of the Gang of Eight, the top four party leaders in Congress and the chairman and vice chairman of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, have not received an additional briefing on the incident, but still claim that it's clear that Russian fighter jets acted intentionally. Senator Rubio claimed this was a deliberate effort. This wasn't some incident, it was some harassment effort that went awry. This was on design. They basically decided we're going to begin to shoot down U.S. assets, whatever's flying in what they call restricted airspace. Russia's ambassador to the United States says U.S. military's unacceptable actions close to the Russian territory are a cause for concern, urging Washington to stop its hostile flights near the country's borders. Russia's ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Antonov, made the remark in a post on his Telegram channel on Wednesday, 15th of March. "We assume that the United States will refrain from further speculation in the media and stop flights near Russian borders. We consider any action with the use of U.S. weaponry as openly hostile," Anatoly Antonov further quoted U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby as saying that U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles made those kinds of overflights on a daily basis.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of a speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, after planting saplings on the occasion of Tree Planting Day on March 23. A few years ago, a number of people wrote a letter recommending that fruit trees should be planted. So we planted fruit trees. This year, some experts and experienced individuals pointed out that non-bearing trees, forest trees, and various other trees that have wood as their fruit, these are also important for the country. What they said is absolutely correct. My advice to everyone is that in addition to fruit trees, they should also plant forest trees, the trees that have important wood, both for using the wood inside the country and also for trading wood products, which is also an important issue. We need to make use of all the economic possibilities that are available to us in our country. When a country is dependent on just one product, this will result in what you see today. We have a problem today. We have a problem in the value of our national currency and also with inflation and high prices.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Our officials should use every economic opportunity at their disposal. Of course, they are working hard. I can see that they are putting in effort. God willing, they will continue these endeavors with strength. And they will find and implement the right solution to solve people's economic problems. We are one of the few countries that have included environmental protection in our constitution. In our constitution, preservation of the environment has been stipulated. This is an important matter. No one should violate this law. This is one of the outstanding features of our constitution. I hope that, God willing, the people will be successful and our officials will be successful with God's grace in carrying out the necessary work that we all have a responsibility to do. I will also like to briefly talk about an issue that has been taking place recently, and that is the issue of, some are saying, the poisoning of students. I'm well aware that our officials have sat together and discussed this issue. They are working hard and they have specified duties. I want to emphasize that they must earnestly investigate this matter. This is an important issue.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Nowruz celebration of New Iranian calendar year to all Iranians and all Farsi-speaking people around the world. I, on behalf of IRIB English Radio staff, congratulate you the beginning of spring.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A scandal involving a Quran desecration at a school in northern England has continued to escalate, despite the resolution of the affair by the local community. With a local mosque and its imam facing a sustained onslaught by right-wingers in the press and government too. Hafez Mohammed Mateen Anwar played a prominent role in easing tensions after news spread across the community of a Quran desecration by students at Kettlethorpe High School in Wakefield. When the news went viral, talk of an alleged death threat and a street protest erupted, Mateen Anwar offered up his mosque to the school and police as a location for a community meeting, an opportunity to clear the air, lay out the facts, and end the matter once and for all.
Now, as far as the local Muslim community are concerned, the situation was dealt with amicably and ended on good terms, with communication playing a big part in making the difference. However, it seems as if the government